Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Lee Ellen Marvin. Marvin is a folklorist and storyteller. She's been involved in storytelling as a producer, organizer, teacher, and performer for over 25 years. She teaches storytelling classes at the Community School of Music and Arts, as well as at Ithaca College. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish.
I want to know when you became intrigued by storytelling. Was it as a child?
No, but as a child, I always knew I wanted to do something in the arts, in part because my parents were both musicians. My mother was an opera singer, and my father a composer and an oboist. And one of the things that was a part of my childhood was before we'd go see an opera that my mother was performing in, because we were living in Germany in the time, so the operas were always sung in German, so she would sit down with my sister and me and tell the whole story of the opera, sing little snatches of the arias to let us know, well, when I'm singing this, this is what I'm singing about. And sometimes we got box seats, so two little girls in state, you know, looking down over the stage, and it was always very exciting. But so I thought when I went to college, theater. But as soon as I got to college, I got this kind of ew response.
In regard to theater?
In regard to theater, because everyone was like me. We had all had the lead role in our senior class play. We were the hit thespians of our high school, and now we were all thrown together at Emerson College, which was very, very strong in theater. And I just couldn't stand our efforts to get noticed.
And also the competition, did that bother you as well?
The competition bothered me. It bothered me that for freshman acting you had to audition. Someone told me years later at a class reunion, oh, that was just to set up a real-life kind of model. And I just said, I'm not interested in it. I just wasn't interested. Suddenly I just backed off of all of that and got very interested in radio. And we had a wonderful college radio station, very active. And when I was a sophomore, we got a stereo signal and a new antenna location, wonderful access. And I did a lot of stuff with radio. And I said, well, I like theater still. So I trained myself in radio drama. And that was interesting. That led me to summer internships at National Public Radio. And learning how to edit tape. And
oh, yes, the days of editing tape are far gone.
Razor blade and scotch tape.
Me too.
And then WGBH Radio snapped me up for a work-study job working for a children's radio program called The Spider's Web.
Yes, I was going to bring that up. Yeah.
And that was fascinating. Now, that was mostly complete readings front to back of children's novels with original music and sound effect treatment. Three or four actors, everyone covering about three or four different characters. And I loved being producer. I really loved the shaping. I loved the interaction with the actors and, you know, my vision and their vision and how are they going to go together.
Did you have to teach people to tone down just to read stories, whereas on the stage, you know, it's bigger?
Maybe I selected the ones who already had that instinctively. But even auditions, you know, they'd be sitting around a table. And so it was a very intimate setting. And that would, I think, settle people down. I think the actors we worked with were wonderful. So I think they quickly got the right sense of the quieter quality of radio drama. And then sometimes we just did things kind of big and really let them be rip-roaring and just, you know, created a more of a kind of a stage quality for some projects. But along the way, at that time, storytellers were just beginning to emerge, calling themselves professional storytellers and letting themselves get hired out to schools and libraries and starting to develop festivals. And we were, occasionally we needed a one or two part program to fill in the gaps that a whole book wouldn't quite make. And I suddenly realized that they were working in a form of theater, that's how I saw it at first, that was completely different. And I said, my goodness, they don't have a script. Every time, you know, if they make a mistake and I ask them as the producer to repeat a segment, they're going to say it a little differently. And then I, as a producer, have to learn how to, you know, fit the new take in with the old take, even if the text isn't quite the same. And I thought, well, why don't they have a script in front of them? And that's when I discovered that they were keeping it open-ended because they were working with audiences and they were looking at the children they were telling stories to and responding to their needs or their interests. And storytellers started saying things to me like, You know, I told this story the other day, and the audience made me tell it a whole new way. I'd never heard it. I never heard it come out of me that way.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you ever told a story to an audience?
Well, it was, I'm not even sure you can use the word audience. Right about that time, some story swap groups got started in the Boston area. And these were simple things. We'd meet in someone's living room. We'd bring a potluck dish. Boston, it's called potluck. Here,
yeah.
It's called dish to pass. And we would bring something to eat. And we would eat, and then the host would get us settled, and we would swap stories. And the idea is that you try to stay open to what's happening in the circle so that you might be reminded of a story you didn't think you would tell that night. And, you know, but someone had told one story and that leads you to think of another story. So that was the community. But I had just left my job at the Spider's Web, and I was in that period of flux. What's next for me? And I decided, okay, I'm going to learn to tell a story. And I learned a story from Mexico about a treasure. And the message of the story was, God will give, even if he has to push it in through the window. And it was a marvelous kind of trickster story about how this poor farmer said, well, you know, I don't know if I should have this gold, so I'm going to leave it right here where I found it. And I told that story, and it was a big hit. I remember working it up a little and trying to figure out, how do you practice?
I was just going to ask you that. How does one learn how to tell a story? It must start with some kind of drama, you know, ability to convey some kind of drama, wouldn't you say?
Not necessarily. I've come across some great storytellers who started as creative writers.
Oh.
Now, they're a little tighter and tense,
uh-huh,
you know, in their bodies, and it takes them a while to learn how to let go.
Uh-huh.
But their stories are beautifully structured, and they really know their way around the beginning, middle, and end.
Uh-huh. So you think that's more important than the way one communicates it?
No.
Okay.
I think you can do great if you come from a theater background or an interest in children and children's literature, mm-hmm, or wanting to write yourself and create. That, you know, Garrison Keillor is basically a writer, mm-hmm, who's looking for a new market for his work. I think that's, as I understand it, where he started.
And he ended up
as a, you know, doing radio and telling stories in his daily radio shows, local broadcasting, and now it's spun off into this. How he does such a huge, long story every single week, I have no idea.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
He's a master at it
as well.
He
is a master, but my sense is he really is a storyteller in that when I saw him perform years ago, he had no script, and I saw him before his long story came up. He was in the back of the room. Some band was playing their hearts out, and Garrison Keillor is scratching his chin, and he's kind of weaving back and forth, and his eyes look really dreamy, and I said, that is a storyteller working his way through the basic elements of that story. He's not exactly sure how it's going to end. And sometimes you listen to Garrison Keillor and you hear him breathing really heavy.
Yeah.
And I go, oh boy, come on now, you can do it. You can find that ending. But so for me, the way I learn a story is I find a story I want, and I just make a simple outline. And then I figure out, well, what are the two most important parts? What's the part that triggers the story and sets an imbalance and gets things moving? And what's the point at which there's a moment of truth when we now realize we can see what the new balance is going to be?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I have to develop an internal movie. I don't know how else to describe it. I have to develop imagery. What do these characters look like? What do their voices sound like? What does this movement of running down the street feel like in the body,
mm-hmm,
or more particularly for this character's body? What's around me? And in the end, it becomes like a remembered experience from long, long ago, or a dream that I had had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How interesting. And do you write that stuff down, or is this the stuff you keep in your imagination?
Mostly I don't write it down. I write some things. I do like to write out character dialogues. I never memorize that, but I just start to get a balance of who says what and when. And I draw pictures to get me to, because I'm not very good on visual imagery. I'm really strong in kinesthetic imagery. I'm pretty strong in sounds because I was trained as a radio producer. But I'm the worst at visual imagery. So I have to force myself to work in that direction, and I do it by drawing a storyboard, a lot like a film producer will create a storyboard.
Huh.
Or I might draw masks of the two or three main characters and study them.
Are your stories always in flux, too, or do they end up being concrete?
They get
entities at some point.
Well, it's interesting. I've just revived a story. After the redbud woods were cut down, and I know I had said to you, well, I could tell this story, and you said, there isn't time. But I remembered a story at the same time that the redbud trees were being cut. And I wasn't sure how I felt about the protest. I feel that Cornell's worked really hard to try to do a lot of environmentally sound things. And at the same time, there's always pressure on a campus to have more parking. So I felt that they were in a rock and a hard place. But when those trees were cut, I was really stricken with how dramatic the change was.
A lot of people felt that way. I was up there as well.
Yeah, and I got a lot more sympathetic for the work that the protesters were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
suddenly, out of my mind, my memory came this story from Greek mythology. It's from Ovid's Metamorphoses. And it's the story of how the goddess Demeter punishes the prince of Thessaly. His name is Eryxithon. He cuts down trees in a sacred grove. That's where the priestesses hold worship for Demeter. And he's warned by an old crone who suddenly appears, and then the goddess herself appears, and they say, don't cut these trees. But he wants to build a banquet hall because he loves to have great long feasts. He's going to build a banquet hall with these trees. And after he cuts them, Demeter curses him, and he becomes hungry, and nothing will fill him. And in the end, he sits in the dirt in the town square, eating the dirt, eating the weeds, and chewing on his own flesh.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's That's dramatic.
Yeah, it's very dramatic. And I was telling this to a couple of other storytellers. Kevin Moss has just started up, reinvigorated the Odyssey Storytellers, which is an Ithaca storytelling group. And here I am saying, and when Eryxithon struck the tree, everyone in the forest could hear a cry of pain. They didn't know if it had come from the men standing or from the tree itself. But one man pointed, look, sir, look! And the sap oozing around the axe blade was red as blood. So I'm telling this moment, and Kevin, who works at the plantations, is just shocked. He just, you know, he's you know,
well, that
shocked.
Is quite an image.
Yeah. And I suddenly go, oh my God, I'm talking about the redbuds. You know, just bang, it hit me. And I had started working on this, but not really knowing why the story had come back. So now what's had to happen was I used to tell that a lot. And I used to really be thinking about consumerism and how we're constantly trying to fill ourselves and nothing fills you.
Right. Absolutely.
And then lately I'm trying to lose a little weight. So I, you know, kind of been thinking about, well, now if you're going to diet, you don't want to do it in a way that you never feel full. You want to figure out what satisfies you, Lee Ellen. So that was part of what brought up that story. But there I was in the middle of telling it and I went, oh, okay.
Oh, boy. You know, when I told somebody that you were going to be on the show, a storyteller, they said, isn't that a lost art? And I thought that was really interesting. I think people think in terms of storytelling as the stories that generations tell to each other, and that does seem to be a bit of a lost art. Do you think so or not?
No. I mean, first of all, because I've chosen it as my profession, I have to say, you know, my theory is no.
Yeah, but storytelling as a performance seems to be having a revival, but storytelling being sent down through generations seems to have...
Well, what we have lost is the telling of fairy tales and magical stories or fables that we had learned from our mother, grandmother, kind of, or father, grandfather, or, you know, cross the genders. So people have to go back to children's books and collections. A lot of parents are really shy about just telling a story. We don't have so often extended family situations where an elder who has time to think about a story and work on how they're going to tell it. You know, the elders are busy with all their volunteer activities basically until they drop, and they just see their grandkids every so often. And yes, we've got a television that's serving as a storyteller these days.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Lee Ellen Marvin, a storyteller. Will you tell us a story?
Sure. Years ago, I got stricken with the idea of wild wolves and wolves in the wild and whether they were surviving. In fact, how I came to that project was a little bit of a story. A friend of mine came to have a cup of tea with me, and she said, I've got to tell you about this book I just read. And I thought, this is strange. This woman has never told me about books. And I mean, I knew she was a reader, but we never really talked about books. But she told me about a book from beginning to end. It was this very curious experience, and I sat there, and I got this little tingle up the back of my neck, and this little voice said, you have to tell this story. And I was like, Tish, you can imagine, who, me, what? Not me, no, I live in cities, I don't know anything about wolves.
Screaming in the dark.
Yeah, this is so weird. And then a couple of weeks later, I couldn't get the story out of my mind. I kept going, why did I have that response? And here I was... at a bookstore, and I don't know what it was I thought I was looking for. I was poking around on a bookshelf, and a book fell out of the shelf and fell on my foot, and I reached down, and there was the title, In the Shadow of a Rainbow by Robert Franklin Leslie, and the true story of a man's encounters with wolves in British Columbia. Mm-hmm. I said, oh my God, that's the one that my friend Mary was telling me about. How weird is that?
Fate.
So... I decided that, fate, it's all landing in my lap. I don't know why, but I'm going to follow it. Let's see, how often do you get a calling, And that led me to reading lots of folk tales, lots of myths, lots of course, the book In the Shadow of a Rainbow and Julie of the Wolves. And, I just fell in love with the whole thing. And then I said, I've got to see wolves. So here's my story. I went down to Washington, D.C., because that was the closest zoo from Boston that I knew of that had wolves on display. And I rode the bus from my friend's house downtown, stepped off the bus, and entered into the big gate that leads into this great big park area right in the middle of the city. I went to the information kiosk, and I said, I'm here to see the wolves. Well, the information officer pulled off a map and circled the spot and said, that's where the wolves displayed is, but you're going to have to be really lucky if you want to see those wolves. And I didn't understand what she meant by that, but I went on down and I followed the map that led me past the elephant house and the flamingos, and I came down this slope to an area that was marked. There was the label, wolves. And lobus, and they had the description of their common grounds and their eating habits and all of those kinds of details. There was a railing, a kind of like a stream or a pond, and then a wooded hillside that stretched up from where I was standing. And the hillside was filled with trees and bushes. It was almost, you'd almost say a little bit scrabby in there. And I looked and I looked and I looked and I paced back and forth, and I couldn't see any wolves. And it was disappointing. A little distance away, there was a beaver display, and there was a guy working there, and he was scraping leaves off the top of the beaver pond, because it was the fall. And I went over, and I said, I'm here to see the wolves. Are they indoors or outdoors today? He said, oh, they're out. They're always out. But you'll have to be really lucky if you want to see the wolves. I've been here for 10 years, and I've only seen them twice. And I said, why? He said, I don't know, but they hide. So I went back, and I looked, and I paced, and I fretted, and I finally said, well, you know what? I don't think I'm going to get lucky. So I will just sit on this bench before I go and take my bus ride back out to the suburbs. I sat on the bench, and I really started enjoying the sunlight and the color of the leaves and the sound of the city way, way off distant. I was looking up and seeing great big apartment buildings with windows that look straight down into the zoo. And I got quiet, and suddenly a shadow under the bushes shaped into a wolf and came down to the pond and had something to drink from the pond. I got excited. I reached for my journal, and as soon as I pulled my journal out of my bag, the wolf noticed me and skedaddled and just melted into the shadows again. Ah, I said, I think I understand. So I got the journal in my lap, and I got my pen poised so I could take notes. And after about 5 minutes of sitting still, another shadow turned into a wolf. a smaller one, and she went down to the water's edge and used her paw to brush away the leaves, and she drank from the pond. And then a leaf came and struck me on the side of the face, and I startled, and as soon as I moved, she noticed me, and she disappeared into the woods again. A young couple came by, and they came right down to the display, and they read the marker there, and they said, "Oh, wolves." They turned to me, and they said, "Are there wolves here?" And I said, "Yeah, they're here, but you really have to get lucky to see them." They said, "We're from Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, and we live where the wolves are living wild." "Ooh," I said, "that sounds so great." I said, "Have you seen them?" "Well, no," said the wife. "I've never seen them, but my husband has." I said, "Please, tell me what it was like." He said, "It was surprising." "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I came around a bend on a forest trail, and there was the wolf, and there was me, and he was surprised, and I was surprised. It was surprising." So after all those years, I learned of living right near the wolves where they could hear them at night, it still was only one encounter of actually seeing them. They went on, and I got quiet again, and the two wolves came out. And now they were free. They were sniffing, and they were exploring. They were scratching in the dirt. But off from a distance, I heard a man's voice. "Come on, little girl. Let's go see the wolves." "What's a wolf, Daddy?" "Well, a wolf is just like a dog. But he likes to eat little girls." "No, Daddy, no, no!" Down the walkway came a man with a little girl on his shoulders. She was screaming, "No, I don't want to see the wolves!" But when they got there, she said, "Where are the wolves?" And the father looked up and down and paced back and forth, and he said, "I don't see them." And they turned to me, and they raised their eyebrows, as if I might be able to tell them where the wolves had gone. And I didn't know what to say. I just shrugged. They went off. Because, you see, the wolves went to a very quiet and still place. And if you want to see those wolves, you're going to have to go to a quiet and still place yourself.
That's great.
Thanks.
It's a great lesson, too, about people just slowing down.
Yeah.
Quieting down and listening to the world around you.
Yeah.
I try to encourage that as well. You know what I wanted to ask you? What's the difference between a folktale and just a plain story? Can you give a different definition?
Well, a folktale is a kind of story. So a story is something happens to somebody,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, a story with a little development, something happens to somebody and it somehow changes the person or the world or their community, and then there's a lot of variations on all of that. A folktale is a story that has circulated through oral tradition, so we don't know who the author might have been if there ever was one author,
mm-hmm.
and there's more than one version circulating. It's been circulating, and it's gone into different communities. So we could find there's no one right version, mm-hmm. and that's a folktale.
Oh, interesting. So it's a metamorphosis of sort of a verbal metamorphosis based on a story.
Well, you know, you can also think of it as jazz. Because I don't have a memorized script, mm-hmm. I think sometimes of storytelling as jazz. There's theme and variation. There's this basic story in my head, but exactly where the beat is going to happen, where, you know, or which word I'm going to choose, or how I'm going to shift a character's voice, that will come out differently each time,
mm-hmm.
based on the audience. And I take up a folktale and I tell it in a really different way than anybody else. And that's what I expect of my colleagues, that each one of us tells a story in a way that uniquely speaks to who we are, where we're coming from, and who we're telling to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful. I love that fluid way of communicating. You know, after the tsunami, you started a fundraiser.
Called Story Tsunami. Yeah.
Tell us a little about that, and do you think you might tackle that for the current crisis in the Gulf?
Well, we're working on it. Story Tsunami was, the idea was to create a wave of benefit stories and a wave of love and compassion told through stories. There were lots of different communities throughout the storytelling world, as it were, or the American storytelling community, that were people were going to, I knew that each of us, we don't have huge audiences. So
mm-hmm.
Here in Ithaca, we raised about $250. And that was true of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. in Asheville, North Carolina, they held a big concert with a lot of really major, well-known storytellers and raised about $1,000. And a couple of events raised more like two, but mostly it was small amounts of money. So one thought was, if we create a centralized theme, publicity vehicle, logo, all of the different communities can more easily produce benefit concerts because they'll have some tools to work mm-hmm. with. And if we also, I never handled any of the money raised by the other concerts. Each concert producer had responsibility of sending the monies they raised to the charity or relief organization of their choice. But what if we count all of that money as one pot? So it went to, what was raised went to many different organizations. I and my central committee picked four target organizations that we thought should be focused: American Red Cross and Mercy Corps, and a couple, and Save the Children, and one other that I'm blanking on. So we had kind of target organizations, mm-hmm. but different people had different, you know, favorite charities in their cities. But when you put all that work together, there were 56 concerts, and we raised $56,000.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, we're not used to thinking of ourselves as being able to generate a great deal of influence, mm-hmm. but that was at least one really good substantial wave of support mm-hmm. for the relief. So, of course, now, as soon as I started to get a sense of how bad this hurricane was, I said, I think I'm going to have to do it again. I'm actually not sure that it will happen again. And the reason is ironic. At this point, it's too soon to tell. But some people are really uncomfortable with the name Story Tsunami.
Really?
Yeah. They say, well, you know, it's like, it's insulting to the people who are suffering from this disaster. And, you know, if you had experienced this, you wouldn't want to have a house burning benefit sale or something. And I said, well, no, I endured a really bad disaster, the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989, mm-hmm. and I really wouldn't have minded if you'd held a benefit and called it Story Quake. I think I would have accepted that.
No, I can't imagine being upset about that.
Yeah, it was an interesting response. And this time people are saying that again, and they're also saying, and besides, tsunami has to do with Asia, and this is, you know, different. And I'm right now saying, yes, but we have materials, we have a website, we have momentum. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to, you know, revise this website to support fundraising for the Katrina relief effort. And we could call it Story Tsunami 2 or Story Tsunami mm-hmm. for Katrina relief. Let me know what you'd like to do. Hmm. But I realize that at some point you have to make choices, so I'm not sure that I personally have the energy to create a whole new name and site. Mm. So it remains to be seen. It's always interesting to see what it takes to bring a community together.
Yes, it certainly does. I want you to mention some of the teaching you're going to be doing next month. Tell us about it.
We only have
a few minutes left.
I'll be teaching a course called Storytelling Basics for Grandparents and Others at the Community School of Music and Arts, which is right downtown in Ithaca. The course is on Mondays at 10:30 in the morning, so it really is a course for people who don't have a day job. Mm-hmm. And the model that I'll be following is that each lesson will start with story prompts to get you remembering things from your life, and then the second half will look at how do you shape that into stories that you could tell to children or other people. Mm-hmm. And there'll be six sessions altogether. I think the first one is October 17th.
That's what I understand, yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Well, we have run out of time. I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tish.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.